Kunjavihari. Jaya Radha Madhava. Gopi Jana Vallabha Girivardhari. Gopi Jana Vallabha Girivardhari. Yashodanandana Vrajajana Ranjana Yashodanandana Vrajajana Ranjana Yamunatiravanachari Yamunati Ravanachari Jaya Radha Madhava Kunja Vihari Jaya Radha Madhava Kunja Vihari Gopi Jana Vallabha Girivardhari Gopi Jana Vallabha Girivardhari Yashoda Nandana Vrajajana Ranjana Yashoda Nandana Vrajajana Ranjana Yamunati Ravanachari Yamunati Ravanachari Jaya Radha Madhava Kunja Vihari Jaya Radha Madhava Kunja Vihari Jaya Om Vishnu Pad Paramahansa Puri Vraja Kacharja Ashtotra Shatashishimad His Divine Grace Iskan Foundracharya Srila Prabhupada Ki Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Gaura Prema Anandi Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya According to my fallible memory, we finished the seventh chapter and we're beginning the eighth. And since we're all shutidars, we don't write the verse on the board. Everyone knows what a shrutidhar is? In previous ages, actually, the Vedas weren't written down. Vyasadeva wrote them down 5,000. Before that, everyone had a photographic memory. So there was no need to see how degraded. We're proud of big hard disks, but because we lost our brain, we need so many extensions, materialistic extensions of the natural capacity of a human being to remember things. So chapter 8 is a description of the character of Bharat Maharaj. Sri Shukuvacha ikadatu mahanajam kritabhishek nayam bhavakashaksho ramaksharam abhigranam murhurta trayam udakanta ubhavivesha. Sri Shukuvacha. Sri Shukadeva Goswami said, Ekada, once upon a time, to, but, Mahanadyam, in the great river known as Gandaki, Krita Abhishek Naimika Avashyakaha. After taking a bath, after finishing the daily external duties, such as passing stool and urine and brushing the teeth. Brahma Aksharam, the Pranava Mantra Om, Abhigrinanaha, chanting, Muhurta Trayam, for 3 minutes, Udaka Ante, on the bank of the river, Ubavishesha, he sat down. Thank you so much for bringing water. Actually, never use it, so to save yourself trouble, no need to bring in the future. Shukadeva Goswami continued, my dear king, one day after finishing his morning duties, evacuating, urinating, and bathing, Maharaj Bharat sat down on the bank of the river Gandaki for a few minutes and began chanting his mantra, beginning with Omkara. There's no purport, so text 2. Tatcha tatarajan harani vipassaya jalasaya bhisam ikavapayo jagama. I'm sorry that I murdered the meter. I couldn't find the right meter. O king, while Bharat Maharaj was sitting on the bank of that river, a doe, being very thirsty, came there to drink. There's a series of texts which we'll read which have no purports. Text 3. While the doe was drinking with great satisfaction, a lion, which was very close, roared very loudly. This was frightful to every living entity and was heard by the doe. By nature, the doe was always afraid of being killed by others, and it was always looking around suspiciously. When it heard the lion's tumultuous roar, it became very agitated. Looking here and there with disturbed eyes, the doe, although it had not fully satisfied itself by drinking water, suddenly leaped across the river. Text 5. The doe was pregnant, and when it jumped out of fear, the baby deer fell from its womb into the flowing waters of the river. Purport, there's every chance of a woman's having a miscarriage if she experiences some ecstatic emotion or is frightened. Pregnant women should therefore be spared all such external influences. Text 6. Being separated from its flock and distressed by its miscarriage, the black doe, having crossed the river, was very much distressed. Indeed, it fell down in a cave and died immediately. Text 7. The great king Bharat, while sitting on the bank of the river, saw the small deer bereft of its mother floating down the river. Seeing this, he felt great compassion. Like a sincere friend, he lifted the infant deer from the waves and, knowing it to be motherless, brought it to his ashram. Purport, the laws of nature work in subtle ways unknown to us. Maharaj Bharat was a great king, very advanced in devotional service. He had almost reached the point of loving service to the Supreme Lord, but even from that platform he could fall down onto the material platform. In Bhagavad Gita we are therefore warned, Yamhina yatayan yete purusham purushar shabaha Samadukka sukham dhiram sumrititvaya kalpate. O best among men, Arjuna, the person who is not disturbed by happiness and distress and is steady in both is certainly eligible for liberation. Bhagavad Gita, chapter 2, text 15. Spiritual salvation and liberation from material bondage must be worked out with great caution. Otherwise, a little discrepancy will cause one to fall down again into material existence. By studying the activities of Maharaj Bharat, we can learn the art of becoming completely freed from all material attachment. As it will be revealed in later verses, Bharat Maharaj had to accept the body of a deer due to being overly compassionate for this infant deer. We should be compassionate by raising one from the material platform to the spiritual platform. Otherwise, at any moment, our spiritual advancement may be spoiled and we may fall down onto the material platform. Maharaj Bharat's compassion for the deer was the beginning of his fall down into the material world. Om Agnati Mirandasya Jnananjala Shalakaya Chakshurun Militam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha. Compassion is the natural characteristic of pure devotees of the Lord. In previous classes, we have discussed the epitome, the pinnacle of compassion, namely Vasudev Dat. His story is so amazing, we have to at least think about it a little bit more. He went to Lord Chaitanya and he said, "My heart breaks due to seeing the sufferings of all living entities. Please send them all back home, back to Godhead. And if you think their karmic overload is too colossal, it's too huge for you to send them back to Godhead, I will take all of their karma. I'm happy to take all of their karma for all living entities." There are more than 7 billion human beings and far more of inferior species. So the total number of living entities, if you add in bacteria, exceeds 10 to the 20th power. To calculate how much karma they have, even Chitragupta, just trying to keep track of the sins of Jagai and Madai, went crazy. He threw down his writing implement and said, I give up, it's too much, when he came to Yamaraj. But Lord Chaitanya nullified all that karma in one instant. So this is the power of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. But Vasudev Dat was actually ready. He was not just saying that. We might sometimes say things like this in order to be recognized and worshipped by others. But the actual situation, this is in Majjhila chapter 15, so none of this is my speculation. It's in Majjhila chapter 15. He was genuinely ready to go to hell for as long as it took to equalize all the sinful reactions of all living entities. So Lord Chaitanya simply began crying. He was so captivated. Can you just imagine the elevated consciousness of a person who's ready not only to happily accept his own karma, which we sometimes begrudgingly accuse the Lord, why are you making me suffer? We're not even ready to accept our own karma. I could accept my own and maybe that of two or three other people. Maybe. If I'm really fired up one day. But he's ready to take everybody's karma. All the rats, all the cockroaches, all the thieves who would have killed him for a dime in downtown Calcutta. He's ready to take their karma. They would have actually exploited him. He doesn't analyze. It doesn't matter to him. All the people who are utterly indifferent to spiritual advancement, like Christopher Columbus in Europe, who lived at the same time. All of these people, by his mercy, went back to Godhead. That's directly stated in Chaitanya Charitamrita. During the 48-year interval when Lord Chaitanya was on this planet, he sent all Stavara and Jangama. Stavara means stationary. It's close to English, so it's easy to remember. Stavara and stationary. And Jangama means moving. Or Chara Achara, as Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita. The moving and the non-moving. All of them went back to Godhead 500 years ago. And then Lord Chaitanya filled up the universe again with another set of living entities. For Lord Chaitanya, this is not a difficult feat. He told Vasudev Dat, I will do it without your having to accept their karma. Lord Chaitanya actually began crying. Imagine if your devotional service is so pleasing to Krishna that the Lord begins crying upon seeing your devotion. That is perfection. That is the perfectional stage. It's very important to hear about the perfectional stage because it gives us encouragement to work our way up the sadhana bhakti ladder. And sadhana bhakti involves a lot of austerities and difficulties. And sometimes if we're not really fired up, we tend to become a little bit hopeless. We tend to lapse into hopelessness but we should keep the perspective, just like Dronacharya was so pleased with Arjuna in Mahabharata, because he only saw the target. Dronacharya asked Duryodhana, "What do you see?" And Duryodhana said, "I see the birds and I see the trees and the mountains." And he said, "Sit down." And asked someone else, Karna and Vikarna and so many. Dronacharya was the military instructor for all of the Kauravas and the Pandavas. Dronacharya was actually a Brahmin. He was very exalted. He had all kinds of mystic powers. But still, he wanted, somehow or other, he wanted some material, I don't know how to say it, comfort or prosperity. Although he was a genuine, like Shukracharya also, interestingly enough. This phenomenon exists of there being Brahmins who have genuine Brahmin tejas, but still they have some tinge of material attachment. But they're to be viewed as great personalities. Dronacharya was personally trained by Parashuram in the military arts. So when he was training the Kauravas and the Pandavas, he was especially pleased with Arjuna because Arjuna was totally fixed on the target. That was his only meditation. He didn't see left, he didn't see right, up or down. So Dronacharya benedicted him and said, "You will be the greatest bowman on the planet." So this is very important to keep the goal in mind because there's so many little things that divert us along the way. The goal is to be utterly fixed in service to Krishna. To have the only interest in our heart is to please Krishna and no other desire. And at present that seems like a very ambitious or lofty goal because we have anarthas, that means things we don't want, other desires that we want to get rid of. We actually, those who are serious, really do only want to surrender to Krishna, but we're overburdened by many anarthas. So by hearing the pastimes of pure devotees, we actually get great encouragement. Just hearing about pure devotees is one of the greatest sources of inspiration. So Lord Chaitanya was crying, and then he went to his devotees and he said, "My body belongs to Vasudev Dat. I'm no longer independent. He can sell my body in any marketplace." This is inconceivable to think about this. The Lord is saying that my body is the property of Vasudev Dat. This is so... It's actually possible. He said that with other devotees. He said that I'm the property of other devotees too. If you're actually pure, if you're actually totally fixed, then this is, you actually become the controller of God. Of course, we don't want to be the controller of God. We just want to be the humble servant. But the Lord had become so pleased, so pleased. And that's the whole point of devotional service, is to please the Lord. So the point being made, Prabhupada is saying in the purport, is compassion. Maharaj Bharat had compassion. But compassion may be misplaced. It may be calculated on the bodily platform and therefore is a mistaken kind of compassion. But still, Maharaj Bharat was so exalted, he couldn't be defeated by Maya's ordinary trick, so Maya had to use another kind of devotional trick, or a trick that could be somehow dovetailed with devotion. Compassion is close to devotion. But somehow he misplaced his compassion, and as will be described in the next few verses, he gradually began to give up his spiritual practice. That was the problem. It wasn't really such a problem to rescue a baby deer, or even raise it to the point of self-sufficiency and then release the deer. That would have been a valid course of action. You raise it till it's self-sufficient and can forage on its own and get its own food and then let it go. That would have been okay, but he actually got attached to the deer and began offering prayers to the deer, as we will see. He began saying that oh my little deer, just by the touch of your hoof prints, the whole earth is glorified. He really got carried away. It's quite inconceivable, actually, because he walked away in the prime of youth from a whole empire. He was the emperor of the whole earth planet. He had beautiful wives and he had qualified sons and owned the whole earth planet. It's really, really hard to understand. he didn't just like go off to the, like if we go off, it's not that we have to anything huge to renounce. For us to renounce our existing status is not a wonderful thing because we don't have very much, but he owned the whole earth planet. And he ruled, it says, for 10 million years, which is also inconceivable. There are many inconceivable aspects of the Srimad Bhagavatam. Even if you live in Satya Yuga, that's considered the longest lifespan of 100,000 years. So Dhruva Maharaj, for example, he was king for 36,000 years, it says in the fourth canto. So out of 100,000 year lifespan, to have a third of that as being the king, that's reasonable. Even in Satyuga, so 36,000, but 10 million spans more than two Chaturyuga cycles. This is, there are all kinds, if you read carefully the Bhagavatam, there's all kinds of things that are difficult to understand. These are called stump the Swami questions. You can keep a list. The next time an advanced devotee comes to give class, the Maharajas, the sannyasis, who are highly trained in Shastric wisdom, you can challenge them. They may not even be able to answer. There are many things that are even beyond the reach of exalted persons like Ramapada Swami when he comes, or Bhaktivikasa Swami even. I've found a few things to stump him, and he's like a genius on all aspects. So because we're conditioned souls, we may not have access to all scriptural erudition and the intricacies of transcendence, is how Prabhupada described it in one purport. It's very intricate. How did he reign for 10 million years? That violates the normal procedure, because that spans more than two Chaturyuga cycles of Kali Yugas. There would have been Kali Yugas going on. So another option is that it was not ruling on the earth, but in higher planets where time moves at a different rate, which correlates with Einstein's general theory of relativity. In the ninth canto, there's a story of Maharaj Kukudmi. He had a daughter named Revati. So he wanted to marry her to a suitably qualified Kshatriya. That's the duty of the king. But this king Kukudmi was no ordinary person. He went all the way to Brahmaloka. He thought, I'm not sure who's really qualified for my daughter. So to find out who's really qualified, I have to go ask Lord Brahma. If you want to get the best information, you go to the highest person. Prabhupada said Lord Brahma's body is made of purely out of the element of intelligence. The elements become finer as you move up the scale beyond Svargaloka. There's Maharaloka, Janaloka and Tapaloka and Satyaloka, the abode of Brahma. As you go up the scale, the elements become more finer. The bodies are made out of a finer constituency of elements of the Bina Ashtita. Ashtada. How do you say that? You're more expert in these things. Bina Ashtada, the separated eight elements. Bina Ashtada. Bina Prakriti Ashtada. Krishna says in 7.4, right? 7th. Chapter text 4, Bhagavad Gita, Krishna identifies these elements as separated. Just like the question came up yesterday about the mind. Mind seems like a person. It talks to you, it pushes you, it pushes you around. Really, it pushes you around really good. Seems like a person, but it's not. It's run by the energy of consciousness coming from the soul and super soul. That's what energizes or empowers the mind. Now, the mind is actually a material element like water. It has no greater influence over you than water, wind or rain. But because we are attached, we want to enjoy. That's the whole problem. The mind can only exert its influence over a conditioned soul. The mind cannot exert influence over the pure soul, purified souls who are unconditioned, who have dissolved. Lord Kapila says you dissolve the mind, the material mind, because the soul has its own spiritual mind. It doesn't need a material mind. So this king Kukudmi, he went all the way to Brahmaloka, which is not an easy thing, by the way. An easy journey to other planets, Prabhupada says you'd have to travel, I forget the numbers, 40 million years, something, some huge. He gives some numbers there for how far away Brahmaloka is, which, by the way, superficially contradicts the 4 billion mile diameter of the earth given, as we read in the fifth canon. There are many tricky things. You got to really be alert if you're reading the Shastra. Easy journey to other planets, Prabhupada gives a different figure for the diameter of the universe. And in Adi Lila chapter 8, in a purport, another figure is given for the diameter of the universe, quoted from Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur's Surya Siddhanta and Siddhanta Shiromani. So to understand Shastra, one has to really be alert. We could go, these are the intricacies of transcendence which we will gradually unfold in successive classes, but I'll stay on the point. I tend to get a little diverted from my initial point. The initial point is, this king, he went all the way to Brahmaloka, and he wanted to see Lord Brahma, so he came to Lord Brahma's secretaries and servants and said, please make an appointment, so let me talk to Lord Brahma. And they said, no problem, just sit and wait here for a short time because Lord Brahma is listening to a concert put on by the Gandharvas. This is in the ninth canto. So he sat down for not very long, an hour at the most, and then he was admitted into the personal association. He got to have an interview with Lord Brahma. That's not a cheap thing, actually. And then he said, I have this daughter, Revati. He brought the daughter with him. So he and Revati were actually there, King Kakudmi and his daughter, and he asked Lord Brahma, please recommend a qualified husband for my daughter. Should I marry? And he began listing some persons that he had seen on the earth planet at the time, and Lord Ma began laughing. He said, all the people you mentioned died 100 million years ago. So 1 hour on Brahmaloka equals 100 million years on the earth planet, which is just like Einstein's general theory of relativity, that time moves at different rates. For observers moving close to the speed of light or in a high gravitational field, so as you get closer to the coverings of the universe, the gravitational field may alter considerably. That's my speculation. That's not part of Bhagavatam. I'm very clear whenever I throw in, but I'm just trying to build a bridge. This is actually something Prabhupada wanted us to build a bridge between the outrageous statements of the Shastra and modern science, which everyone gives great credibility to. Actually, the modern science is very feeble because it's based on the mind and senses. So it's sure to go wrong. But interestingly enough, this is, if you chart the history of physics from Newton in the 1600s up until quantum mechanics and relativity, it's actually step by step moving closer. Physics is moving closer and closer to the Vedic knowledge. So although it's based on the most inferior form of acquiring knowledge, namely pratyaksha, if you're using material senses, pratyaksha, or direct sensory input, is the lowest form of knowledge in the Vedic epistemology. Higher than that is Shastra Praman, or statements from Shastra, because superior beings are giving the information. The objection of modern people is, how do you know that they're telling you the truth? That's what, if you talk to a physicist, Prabhupada had a conversation in 1973 with a physicist named Dr. Benford from University of California, Irvine. It's recorded in Science of Self-Realization, this conversation, at least in the earlier versions. Is it still in the SSR? Conversation with Dr. Benford, a physicist. So Dr. Benford, Prabhupada said, why are you using these imperfect tools, mind and senses? And Dr. Benford said, yes, you're right, the mind and senses are inferior tools, but what else do we have? How do I know that Vyasadeva is a genuine person? Maybe it's all mythology. How does anyone really know? How do Westerners have faith in Vyasadeva? Or I met a devotee from South India. Actually, he comes here. He comes here to the Sunday feast. His name is Amarnath. He comes, he's really sweet. You know him. I met him 7 years ago in L.A., and he said, he didn't believe in Lord Chaitanya because he didn't know any, he'd never heard of, who is Krishna? I remember he said, who is this Krishnadas Kaviraj? And so I said, well, who is Vyasadeva? You believe in Vyasadeva because you grew up hearing stories. And then he admitted that's true. He had a double, he didn't recognize that he had a, that his, he was thinking that Bhagavatam is totally bona fide, but Chaitanya Charitamrita is questionable. And I said, why do you accept Bhagavatam? So I got him thinking a little bit, because he grew up hearing stories of Bhagavatam, because he grew up in a pious South Indian family. So the problem is establishing authority. Who shall we accept as authority? And interestingly enough, the physicists just use the power of the mind and senses. But because they're very rigorous and they're very exacting, and they have a protocol and a systematic procedure, they're actually moving towards the Vedas. They're actually moving at a glacial pace. It took them 400 years. A glacier moves about an inch a year. So they're moving at a glacial pace. They could have saved a lot of time and trouble if they had accepted the Vedic knowledge, but because They have doubts about the Vedas. They're moving. But actually, quantum mechanics, which establishes vibration as the origin of everything, is exactly like Lord Kapila's Sankhya philosophy from the third canto, where Lord Kapila describes that in the beginning there's Shabda, and when Shabda vibrates within false ego, divided into three categories, there's false ego in the mode of goodness, false ego in the mode of passion, and false ego in the mode of ignorance. This is all from chapter 26 of the third canto, Lord Kapila's exposition of Sankhya. When Shabda, and it always says Prachodayat, impelled by the Supreme, Daiva Prachodayat, it's impelled by Vishnu. It doesn't happen by accident. That's modern science tends to think that the elements themselves have some power to organize themselves. That's the sharp dividing line between Western epistemology and Vedic epistemology. In Vedic epistemology, the material elements lack the power of self-organization. But in Western epistemology, the material elements lack the power of self-organization. In Vedic epistemology, the material elements lack the power of self-organization, but in Western science, the material elements have inherently the power to organize themselves. This is really the sharp dividing line. This is really the cutting edge of our preaching. In academia, does matter have the power to organize itself? Or doesn't it? And that's a question pertaining to the properties of matter. So by studying matter, this question could be answered. This is entirely distinct from religion, actually. This is simply a question of what matter can and cannot do. The problem is, matter is very subtle. In fact, you can't even really define matter, to be honest. No one actually can define matter. Physicists cannot, because as you break it down further and further, it vanishes. If you look at an atom, the atom is 99% empty space. There's just electrons in the outer shells. And the nucleus is so small, the diameter of the nucleus of an atom is so small compared to the outer radius of the atom, it's as though you had a pea or a marble, 1 centimeter in diameter on a football field. And then when you analyze what is the nucleus, that also vanishes. It breaks down. It's a combination of, used to be thought to be a combination of protons and neutrons, but now they've found that neutrons and protons are made out of mesons, and when you analyze mesons, they're said to be made out of quarks. So at each stage, they find the thing is made out of something more subtle, and no one even knows what quarks are. They have to pull out terms like strangeness and charm. Those are the characteristics. They used to use words like charge. An electron has a certain charge, negatively charged. Electrons are negatively charged. So that had at least some intersection with our ordinary perception of how things operate, charge and mass. Which, if an item has a certain mass or a certain charge, we can understand what that means. But things have become so subtle and so removed from our ordinary daily sense perception that they have to pull out terms like charm and strangeness to deal with quarks. And this, what I'm telling you now, is the science of physics of the 1970s when I was studying physics, and I'm 40 years out of date. Now they have even more wild, utterly bizarre theories. I was just checking on internet, the latest thing is that 75% of the universe is missing dark energy and dark matter. That's really bizarre. It's become totally wild. Physics is gone hog wild. Because they're actually the last, out of the four legs of religion, the one thing that still has some credibility in modern society is truth. They're actually looking for the truth. Except if it's God. Just so long as God is not involved. But we must say that they're finding elements of the truth, because the history of physics from Newton in the 1600s up to today is they're actually moving towards the Vedas. Quantum mechanics and relativity are much closer to Vedic knowledge. They're extremely close, in fact. Einstein had a conception of the ether. The special theory of relativity was formulated in 1905, and it lacked an ether. That was Einstein's first attempt. It was 1905. The big stuff happened 100 years ago, by the way. The major revolutions in physics, quantum mechanics and relativity, occurred a full 100 years ago. They're still trying to pick up the pieces and sort out what happened. It was like a hurricane went through and demolished all the previous conceptions of physics. So in 1905, Einstein had the special theory of relativity, and that lacked an ether. But in 1915, he came up with the general theory, which has an ether. In fact, Einstein said space without ether is unthinkable. There would be no propagation of light without an ether element. Although people nowadays don't recognize this. They don't realize this. I'm explaining all these things in my new book, actually. That it's actually very Vedic. The general theory of relativity is very Vedic. It has an ether element. And the space is no longer ideal Newtonian nothingness. The idea of ideal nothingness, which was Newton's concept of space, has been replaced by Einstein's ether element, which is entirely Vedic, and there's something there. The ether is a real element. It's one of these ashta... How do we say it again? Thank you. Sometimes my brain cuts out. It doesn't function. And I apologize. Everyone is sitting here and forced to listen to me as I'm fumbling around for the right terminology, to which I greatly apologize. The assembled Vaishnavs. So these eight separated elements, there's the ether element is really something. In fact, it's the connecting element between the neurons and the mind element. When the neurons are firing away, a neuron firing means sodium and potassium is moving through the axons of neurons. I don't know if I'm torturing the audience with unnecessary stuff or enlivening the audience. I have noticed a bewildered and tormented facial expression, and other people are enlivened. It's very difficult giving a class to a mixed audience. Anyway, you can imagine a neuron to be like this metal tube. Just imagine it's like this metal tube, and it's hollow, so things flow inside of it. And to make it a little more complicated, the tube has holes in the outside of it, so things move in and out of those holes. They move radially in addition to longitudinally. And what moves radially are ions, sodium and potassium ions. This is how your brain works. So when the sodium ions are moving, just the motion of a charged particle produces electromagnetic waves. This is basic Maxwell's. Everyone's into Maxwell's four partial differential equations, I guess. Everyone is bewildered except one. Are you a science student? Engineering student? Some engineering or science students. Anyway, when charges move, charged particles move, they produce waves, electromagnetic waves, and those waves move in the ether. This is from the third canto, chapter 26. And these affect the mind. So when you think of something with your mind, you visualize something within your mind like a baseball bat within your mind. You're actually creating projections of waves. That's how psychic powers work. People can read other people's minds because they pick up these waves. This is the whole field of parapsychology. It's quite interesting, actually. And it's all Vedic. See, the science is definitely moving. It's really, really moving in the direction of the Vedas. If you were in Europe 400 or 500 years ago, it was very barbaric. The Europeans were deviant Kshatriyas who left India. But because of their, Prabhupada said, because of your Vedic spirit, you're moving back in the direction of the Vedas. Even though they rejected the Vedas, but just want to do it all themselves, they're actually just, this is interesting, because just by the mind and senses, they're moving back towards Vedic truths. It's kind of an interesting progression. So, Lord Brahma, he was actually laughing, because all the people that Kakudmi had proposed, all the Kshatriyas who were living on the earth at the time, had died 100 million years ago. So 100 million years passed on the earth, time, and but 1 hour passed on Brahmaloka. Just see that it's called time dilation in Einstein's theory. Dilation, time dilation is the technical term, dilated time. And it's all over the Vedic literatures, left and right and up and down. In the 29th chapter of the 10th canto, the pure devotees of Sri Vrindavan Dham, the gopis, the highest, the greatest of all devotees. Lord Chaitanya said there are no greater devotees than the Vrajavadu, that the damsels of Sri Vrindavan, Sakir Anugatakoro. That's why we're always praying to become followers of the Sakis. So these are the greatest devotees, and their desire to satisfy Krishna's senses, although it's sometimes described as though they had some lusty desires, factually they had only the desire to satisfy Krishna's transcendental senses. And they had such a strong desire to satisfy Krishna's transcendental senses that Krishna expanded the night that he danced in Rasa dance to 4 billion years, a night of Brahma. That's a massive time violation. That's like, Krishna just like blows away all, Krishna and Lord Chaitanya, they like blow away all the rules. Because God is the creator of the laws of physics. Laws implies lawmaker. But if you say that nowadays, people will not like that. So laws of physics, the maker of the law can actually violate the laws. We're under the control of the material energy. We cannot violate the laws ourselves. The laws of time and gravity are immutable for us. We cannot, without Krishna's empowering us, we cannot violate these laws. But Krishna, being the controller of time and space, he actually extended, this is in the 29th chapter, the Rasa Dance description. It's the Krishna book, 29th chapter or 10th canto, same thing. That actually, Shukadeva Goswami says that Krishna expanded that night to a whole night of Brahma, just to satisfy the pure desires of his pure devotees. Krishna is conquered by his pure devotees. When a pure devotee desires, like Vasudev Dat, he desired. You just have a desire. This is really a lot of power. I mean, when I have a desire, it doesn't do anything. But a pure devotee, like Prabhupada, wanted Juhu Temple, and he had to fight. You know, Mr. Nair tried to cheat the devotees left and right, and Lord Nrisimhadev came and finished him off. This is all in the Lilamrita. Just having a desire. Prabhupada, like he wanted Westerners to become devotees, which is actually impossible. Become serious, fixed up brahmacharis and sannyasis who dedicate their whole life. I mean, that is actually magical potencies. When Prabhupada desired it, Bhrigupati, he likes to tell, everyone knows Bhrigupati? He tells this story that Prabhupada was desiring, and normally it's not possible, but there's a purport in the fourth canto where it's Prabhupada explains that because a devotee desires it, Krishna changes people's hearts and turns them into devotees. I forget exactly where that purport, it's an amazing purport in the fourth canto. People who are not charted or destined to become Vaishnavas, who are as far away as you could get from religious systems, they became devotees simply because Prabhupada desired, and Krishna can make anyone a devotee. He can just inspire you in the heart to feel like being a devotee. He has that magical potency. All the things we're struggling to achieve can be delivered in 1 second by the Supreme Personality, namely pure love of God. And he did it in his form as Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. He did it. In Adi Lila chapter 17, there was a Muslim who was sewing clothes for Srivas Thakur. He was a meat eater. It says directly there he was a meat eater. He was not even following the four regs. He was a tailor. He was a Muslim. It's in Adi Lila chapter 17. But he was serving Srivas Thakur. Thakur means, Prabhupada said, as good as God. It's a very rare title, like Bhaktivinoda Thakur, Haridas Thakur. Those persons are on the highest level. They're Mahabhagavats, Uttama Adhikaris. Simply because he was serving a pure devotee, this person who was unqualified in every other aspect, Lord Chaitanya, one day he came to him and just looked at him. He just glanced at him, and that Muslim became overwhelmed with ecstatic love of God and became a pure devotee instantly with no sadhana, no 16 rounds, no Mangal Arti. No struggle, nothing, no sadhana bhakti. It's kripa siddhi. He became a kripa siddha, having received the potency of the Lord. This is inconceivable. Actually, Lord Chaitanya and Krishna break all the rules. Everyone else follows the rules. Ramchandra is the exemplar for following all the rules. There are different moods. Narayan and Ramchandra, Matsya Kurma, they follow all the protocols, you know, how things are supposed to be done. So when Shurpanakha approached Ramchandra in the Janastan and said, "I am captivated by you. Let's enjoy together." And Ramchandra said, "I have taken Eka Patni Vrata." Everyone probably knows Eka. Patni means wife, and Vrata means vow. So he took a vow This Ramchandra was, he was as attractive as Kamadev. Also when he went to Mithila to marry Sita. Sita was in the city of Mithila. The king was Janaka, Janak Maharaj, one of the Mahajans. All the ladies who saw Ramchandra stride into Mithila, Ramchandra was as attractive as Kamadev. He was so beautiful. Although he was not wearing the peacock feather and didn't carry the flute, everyone's heart was enchanted by the beauty of Lord Ram. But Ram had taken a vow, so he couldn't. The Madhijis, they approached him secretly of Mithila. And the sages in Dandakaranya, who were meditating on Gopal, these sages had their spiritual, they were very advanced sages in the Dandakaranya. They were great rishis who for thousands of years were meditating on Gopal, Shamsundar in Vrindavan. That was their mood. Shamsundar was not due to appear for another 2 million years. This is in Treta Yuga. But they recognized Ram, even though he lacked the flute and peacock feather, the characteristic paraphernalia of Shamsundar in Vraj Dham. Still, their hearts were captivated. They were enchanted by Ram. So they approached Ram, these sages, and they said, Yata Sita Tata Na. That means, as Sita, let us become. Actually, it was in their mind. They didn't even speak it out loud. And Ram said, because of your purity, I would arrange for the fulfillment of your desire instantaneously, but I have taken a vow. Ram was so pleased. These sages had undergone austerities for thousands of years. He said, I would have arranged instantly for the gratification of your desire that you become as Sita. In other words, they wanted a conjugal relationship. They were so advanced they didn't identify with their bodies. They were sages, you know, wearing deer skins and long matted hair, you know, in the male form. It's kind of a rasa bas. If you identify with the body, they were so exalted, these particular sages in the Dandakaranya, they were off the bodily platform. They no longer identify with their physical bodies. They had realized their internal svarup, which happened to be a conjugal mood. So they prayed. They didn't even pray externally, just within their minds. They were so elevated. They were functioning on the higher platforms of mind and intelligence. They were no longer in the gross conception of life. And Ramchandra is omniscient. This is one of the features of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. The word omniscient is Latin, omniscient. Omni means all, but in Sanskrit it's sarvagya is the word term used. Sarva means all and gya means knowing. So he was all-knowing, Ramchandra. And so he knew their heart's desire and he said, I'm inclined to immediately fulfill your desire, but I cannot because I've taken ekapatni vrata. So Ram was like the ideal personality. He's like following all the rules. He did it out of duty's sake. Everything was duty and rules. And if you read the Ramayana, it's very good actually for neophytes, because before appreciating Gaur Leela, what to speak of Vraj Leela, one should understand Mahabharata, Ramayana, and Bhagavatam, which is duty, rules, and regulations for systematic elevation. Because as long as you identify with your body, or more fundamentally, as long as you're envious of Krishna, that's the real problem. If you're envious of Krishna, you cannot properly relate to the higher rasas. You make offenses within your mind. If you try to meditate on Krishna's Madhurya Leela in an immature stage, you will make offenses. First of all, you're thinking, I would like to have my own Madhurya Leela. Prabhupada actually said in one lecture that we left the spiritual world attracted by beautiful women. Prabhupada said that. So that's a major, major cause, or opposite sex, of course, one relates according to situation. But we actually left the spiritual world, this maitunya bhav. Maitunya means mundane physical attraction. So that, if you hear Radha and Krishna Leela prematurely, you start getting into your own thoughts. That was my Leela before I became a... Actually, Leela, it does not apply to the conditioned soul. But anyway, you know how the mind works. We're not qualified. That's why there's a whole systematic procedure for elevation. So Ramchandra, he exemplified this. He wanted everyone to follow all the protocol, so much so that when his citizens... Later on, after he had rescued Sita and brought her all the way back, after so much endeavor, he brought her all the way back to Ayodhya. And Prabhupada says the king, one of the duties of the king is to dress up and be like a spy and go out in the, he would just walk around in the streets. The king would dress up like an ordinary citizen, walk around the streets and just listen to what people said. It's also in Krishna book. Just to hear how this, because the king wants to know if the citizens are satisfied. The modern rulers couldn't give a damn. Just pay your taxes and go to hell. Couldn't give a damn if you live or die. But the beauty of the Vedas, if you read the Ramayana and Mahabharata, it's captive. It really enchants your heart. Like the king, Dasarath, he would walk out on the streets and the citizens would love him. He would have an open interview, like a court. He would have anyone could come and address. You cannot go to the White House and see the President of the United States. It is impossible. Because he's such a rascal, he has to be guarded by 50 million security guards, and everyone's afraid that you're going to assassinate him. Because his qualities are so low, somehow by tricks and cheating, and mostly by the foolishness of the voters, an utterly unqualified person seizes control. In the 12th canto, it's described the anomalies of the age of Kali. It says the citizens will be so harassed, they'll go to the hills and mountains to avoid they'll be like dasyu. The term is dasyu, with the short. Dasyu means like a dacoit who corners you on the highway, a highwayman who at gunpoint he demands, you know, your money or your life. That's a dasyu, not a pickpocket, Prabhupada says. There in the 12th canto, Prabhupada didn't translate, in lectures on this subject, Prabhupada made this point very clear that they're like dasyu, they're like dacoits, the modern rulers. So, you read the Mahabharata and the Ramayana, everyone, they love the king. They genuinely love the king. Except for persons like Duryodhana. Anomalies. There were always anomalies, like Vena. And that makes the point. And how you deal with anomalies is you get rid of the guy. And they did it. When people were unqualified, which was rare, when an unqualified person managed to get into power, he was removed by the magical potencies of Brahmins, by sound vibration. The Brahmins, simply by sound, they cursed him to die. And people, in modern society, someone said, well, this is mythology, I can't believe. But again, quantum mechanics says sound vibration is the source of everything. So that's why it's valuable to build a bridge, because modern people think that the Bhagavatam is mythology. When they hear of a Brahmin lighting a fire by mantra, or killing a rascal by words only, they say this is impossible, but it's not. Quantum mechanics is showing how the fundamental basis of everything is vibration. Shabdam is sound, it just means vibration, oscillations, or fluctuations, or vibrations. In Sanskrit, it's shabda. So quantum mechanics has the basis of everything to be sound vibration, or vibration in general, not sound. Sound, in modern physics, sound is a longitudinal compression wave, where it's my vocal cords are pushing air molecules, so in a vacuum there's no sound. If you preach at university and say everything is based on sound vibration, then someone will object. They will pull out the classical experiment, which you do in your beginning physics course. You have a bell jar with it, you have a buzzer, you have an electric buzzer that is buzzing and making a sound, and you put it in a jar, a glass jar, and you have a vacuum pump hooked up, and you begin to evacuate the jar. So you can hear the buzzer becoming fainter and fainter. It's buzzing away at the same sound level. It's making it like an alarm clock. But because the air is removed, the buzzer, you can't hear it. So sound, what we call sound is, in physics, is a longitudinal compression wave. My vocal cords are pushing air molecules. And if there's no air, you don't hear anything. So if we have to be very alert if we try to preach at universities. Otherwise, we make fools out of ourselves. So shabda is more than just sound vibration. It also includes sound, but it's something subtler. When shabda is vibrating in the element of false ego in the third canto, chapter 26, and producing all of the elements sequentially, as described by Lord Kapila, it's much more than just gross sound, the sound that you're hearing me speak now. There are much subtler levels of sound. The Hare Krishna mantra can be analyzed on a gross level. You could have an oscilloscope, and you could see oscilloscopic modulation occurring by what I'm speaking now or by the chanting of the Hare Krishna mantra. That's the crudest or grossest level of the Hare Krishna mantra. There are much subtler levels on which the mantra operates. So we should understand all these things in right perspective. And as usual, I got carried away. It's 8:30, so I'm going to stop now. There are many, we raised many topics which I did not exhaustively describe. But we will, it's sort of like a spiritual smorgasbord. You get a little taste of everything. All the way from Vraj Prem down to quantum mechanics and everything in between. So I will stop at this point, and I love to answer questions, but anyone who wants to leave can also leave because you have duties to perform. When you think of a baseball bat, if you close your eyes and you visualize a baseball bat, or some, that's a bad example, say an Artic tray, or they visualize the beautiful form of Kishore Kishori, you're actually creating a waves in the ether element. But when the mind operates, this is from Third Canto, chapter 26, text 34, Prabhupada says, the action of the mind is to produce images, to produce forms in the ether. Third Canto, chapter 26, text 34. And the purport, Prabhupada says, this verse is the basis of great scientific research work. So here you go. All those who are too, whose minds are too restless to do book distribution or wave a chamara fan in front of Sri Kishore Kishori, if your mind is too restless, here's infinite service. I can give you so much service in studying physics, so much needed service for pushing on Krishna consciousness that you'll, even if you had 100 lifetimes, you couldn't finish it. And this is something that needs to be researched, how the mind produces forms in the ether. There are scientists, there are physicists at Princeton University and Stanford University, two major universities, and they're doing secret in the basement, they're doing parapsychology research, like Robert John, J-A-H-N, Robert John and Brenda Doon at the Princeton University Engineering. They're professors. By day, they do ordinary research and publish in ordinary journals, but by night, they do forbidden research, clandestine. At night, it's like, you know, the taboo. Parapsychology is taboo in modern science because it was abused, because the mediums, like Uri Geller in the 1970s, who moved objects with his mind, he was studied by two physicists at Stanford University, Puthoff and Targ, who are still writing. They're still writing. Uri Geller made a big splash, but when he couldn't, he actually had some genuine powers by working with ghosts. He acquired, because Westerners can't do the austerities to get their own mystic powers as the Vedic yogis do. So the way Westerners get power, mediumship, they get power by working with subtle beings like ghosts. But when the ghosts don't perform, they take to cheating, and when they're caught cheating, then the whole field falls into disrepute. So in academia, the subject matter of parapsychology has fallen into disrepute. It's considered, you know, nonsense, garbage. But there was one medium who was never caught cheating, and he had truly impressive powers. His name was Daniel Dunglass Home. He lived more than 100 years ago. That's a problem, because nowadays people say, oh, that was 100 years ago. But as Darwin, when Darwin was writing The Origin of Species in 1865, this Daniel Dunglass Home was levitating out of the windows from third-story buildings in broad daylight. And he was studied by a Nobel Prize-winning physicist from the University of London named Sir William Crookes. He won a Nobel Prize. These are not amateurs. They were top-level physicists who studied his activities. But because it was so bizarre, it was so outrageous. Because all the other mediums, they do it in darkened, you know, a seance. You have a darkened room so you can cheat a little bit when the ghosts don't help you move objects. They all perform in a darkened room, you know, seance is the term. So that's why it got this, it got the whole, you know, like the Twilight Zone, the weird, it became disreputable, this field. But there are a bunch of serious scientists like at Princeton University and Stanford University today. And in the past, for the last 100 years, parapsychology has been actively studied by physicists. Physicists are more open-minded than other people. Biologists are really closed-minded. I don't know why, but they tend to be really dogmatic. Physicists are quite enlightened, quite intelligent and open-minded. They read the Vedas. Schrodinger And Heisenberg, has anyone heard of Heisenberg and Schrödinger, the founders of quantum mechanics? And Bohr, those are the three. Niels Bohr, he was a Danish physicist. On his coat of arms, he had the yin and yang symbol. So he was studying Eastern philosophy, and Schrödinger directly quoted from the Upanishads. Schrödinger is the most famous, Schrödinger's equation. Werner Schrödinger, so they lived about Werner Heisenberg and Erwin Schrödinger. They lived 100 years ago. Quantum mechanics was developed in the 1920s, actually. They all studied the Vedas, and they're quoting an Oppenheimer in the 1940s when the first bomb was detonated in New Mexico. Because of Hitler, all the Germans came to work for the American program. So Oppenheimer, everyone has heard of Oppenheimer? He was a physicist who defected. Einstein also left Germany. So they all came. Einstein wrote a letter to Roosevelt. He said, you better watch out. The Germans are going to get an A-bomb and ruin you. So they began, the Americans began. And Oppenheimer, when he quoted from the 11th chapter about when the first atomic bomb was detonated in New Mexico, he quoted the famous time I am, destroyer of the world, right out of Bhagavad Gita. The German scientists are quoting right out of Bhagavad Gita in the Upanishads. It's actually mind-blowing. So the modern science is actually coming from the Vedas. We're trying to instill, why am I talking about all this stuff? We're trying to instill faith in, or if you go to University of Chicago today and you just sit down with some student on the grassy lawn and talk to them, you'll see how steeped they are in impersonalism and how far away they are from Vedic knowledge. So, but they respect Heisenberg and Schrödinger. We understand that they're speculators. We personally don't have great respect for Western science. It is a very inferior form of acquiring knowledge. But Prabhupada, Lord Chaitanya, and Vasudev Dat want us to preach to these people. We could take the view, all right, let them go to hell. They're fools. Bring me another pakora and some chutney. Let these guys go to hell. They don't believe in the Vedas, they go to hell. That's one way to operate. That's called Kanishta Adhikari. You don't care about other people. Or you can also distribute many books, and you personally will go back to Godhead. There's no doubt. That's the fastest way to get Lord Chaitanya's mercy. But along with that, that's the best preaching. Book decision is the best preaching of all. But along with that, Prabhupada did want us, when someone gets a book, and they come to the temple and they say, I love this book, but I can't believe in these four-headed people, you know, flying around on swans. I mean, you guys are nice and your prasadam is great, but four heads. And worse than that is Banasura. This is in the 10th canto. Prabhupada loves, he just blows everyone's mind right and left. He says, Banasura has 1,000 arms. Personally, I didn't have any trouble. I was trained in physics, so I understood higher dimensional aspects of quantum mechanics, that the forms can operate in higher dimensions. So when I joined, it wasn't a problem, but many people freaked out. Sadaputta told me that when the fifth canto came out around 1975, that many devotees blooped. They blooped. Even people living in the temples blooped. Prabhupada, it was one class, Sadaputta was listening to one class, he said, that Prabhupada is saying, there are rivers of nectar on the moon. If this is false, all the Vedic literatures are false. So Prabhupada, he would like stick it in your face. He was like outrageous. He was Prabhupada just was like revolutionary. He was outrageous. And so the Indians who come to the temple nowadays, the Indians who come to this country generally come to study Western science or engineering. And they get trained up. So the Indians who come have naturally bhakti in their heart, but at the same time they have all this Western stuff. So they have to have like a divided house of faith. Half of me believes in the Vedas because of piety, punya. Your birth in India means you have an automatic level of piety. There's no accidents. You took birth there because you had worshipped Vishnu in previous lives. You have some tendency to worship Vishnu or Narayan. But at the same time, Western science is so impressive in its so-called achievements. You know, everyone pulls out their cell phone. Who is that? It wasn't built in India. It wasn't designed nowadays, maybe. But I mean, the electromagnetic laws of Maxwell's laws were developed by a British physicist named Maxwell, the four partial differential equations that govern electromagnetic propagation were developed by a scientist named Maxwell in England. So all of the science and technology is coming from the Europeans, but actually the Europeans got it from the Vedas. So that's why I'm trying to bring it back and to help the people in this country to have faith in the Vedas, we can draw parallels and bridges, because modern science is really actually coming from Vedic information. Hitler had a huge program to translate the Vedas. He believed so much. He had the Vedas being translated. The Germans were the first Europeans to translate Sanskrit into a European language, before the British. People don't know this. It was actually the Germans were the first. They went there and studied left and right. Hitler was really into it. He was so into it. When Einstein came to America in the 30s, he defected. He wrote a letter to President Roosevelt. Actually, that changed the history, modern history. Einstein wrote to Roosevelt and said, you guys better get your A-bomb program together, otherwise you're going to be speaking German pretty soon. And because of that, Roosevelt took it seriously, and we did develop, the Americans developed the A-bomb first, but the Germans, actually the Germans were ahead, and it's only because the Americans put on a rush job, and that using German scientists. Werner von Braun was the head of the U.S., the NASA rocket system. He's German, and Oppenheimer also. Most good scientists are actually Germans. They seem to dominate the field, actually. And they were heavily into the Vedas, more than anybody else. These are kind of interesting parallels if you go deeply into the scientific. So these are ways that you can... The point of all this mundane stuff, I really would rather talk about Vasudev Dat and Vraj Prem. The point of all this stuff is to help these people. It's compassion. The point of the verse today, Bharat Maharaj had compassion. So we have compassion, but it's rightly situated compassion, not bodily oriented compassion. We have compassion to help these bewildered conditioned souls who are totally lost. They're running full speed towards sense gratification, these modern people, everywhere in the world, even in India nowadays. 50 years ago, Prabhupada said in big cities like Mumbai, the women would wear a head covering. Nowadays, in big cities like Mumbai, Delhi, and Kolkata, the girls don't wear head coverings anymore. And now there's billboards advertising illicit activities in major cities of India. So Kali, the personality of Kali, has made inroads even into Bharatavarsha, the land of piety. And I gave lectures in 1992. I gave scientific lectures at universities in India, in Bhuvaneshwar and Calcutta, and they were just as atheistic as their Western counterparts. Even more, they raised more objections when I tried to introduce the chanting of Hare Krishna mantra in 1992. In Bhuvaneshwar and Kolkata, I was giving lectures at universities. I was invited to give lectures there. They were worse. They were more atheistic. After giving my scientific stuff, then I tried to get all the students to chant Hare Krishna mantra. That's how we, in the old style Hare Krishna preaching, which isn't so bad. First I gave the science, the physics and quantum mechanics, and then after all that, what is the use of all that stuff without the Maha mantra? So when I began, I said, now let's all chant. And the professor said, wait a minute, we don't want this nonsense, this sentimentality. And that was in Kolkata, that was in, you know, the land of Dharma. This is the land of piety. So you see, we have to use science nowadays. It's unavoidable. They've conquered the age of Kali. This is the weapons of Kali. She has her science and technology to bewilder everyone into believing that everything is material. So we have a huge amount of work to do. The book distributors, you just keep doing your thing. That's the highest thing. But if you can't be a book distributor, like me, I was a failure. So if you're a failure in book distribution, then it become a preacher or also deity worship. If you can't do deity worship or book distribution, then become a science preacher. And I can coach you. There's no lack of service. There's so much. You could be fully engaged 12 hours a day for hundreds of years. I have so many ideas. I've written, anyone who wants, I can give you my email. I'm writing a whole book on this. It's unlimited in chemistry, self-organization of matter, self-replicating molecules at the dawn of evolution. In physics, the Big Bang, we want to know what started off the Big Bang. So there's unlimited avenues of research for everyone to do. It's just beyond your conception. We should be fully engaged. There should be no spacing out. Then you get the mercy of Krishna. No crazies, no lazies, Prabhupada said. So to understand the vacuum element and the mind and how it works, this is a whole class. We have to study Lord Kapila's and we have to study some quantum stuff. It's like a whole class in itself. I didn't really answer your question very well. Because we get carried away by the waves of... There's so many... Vedas are so ecstatic. Vedic philosophy is so ecstatic. What's to speak of Vraj Prem? That's really the goal. What I'd really like to talk about is the ecstatic love that Vasudev Dad is handing out and Lord Chaitanya is handing out. That's the real nectar. That's also Vedic. Yes, that's physics. String theory is the attempt to understand all matter in terms of strings, but the string is actually, it's a higher dimensional reality, a multi-dimensional reality. Actually, there's a verse that Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, everything is strung, everything rests on me as pearls are strung on a thread. I don't know, seventh chapter, Sutra Gana. Sutra means a thread. Sutra. Everything rests on me as pearls are strung on a sutra, Krishna says. And that's string, and that's what's actually going on. Everything rests on Krishna's energies. To understand that, you'd have to understand some high-level calculus and math to understand how string theory works. That's a problem, actually. All this physics involves a lot of math. So it's hard to say much more than that. It's higher dimensional reality. See, physics believes, like Banasura. Here's an example to help you understand. This is right in the 10th canto. Banasura, he was a demon. Actually, he was the son of Bali Maharaj. Prabhupada says that all of his activities were praiseworthy. That blew my mind. That's what it says in the Krishna book. All of his activities were praiseworthy because he never deviated from his vow of truthfulness. So he was a demon. Sometimes the demons have good qualities. Well, like Bali Maharaj was not a real demon. I mean, somehow they're like covertly in that position, or Prahlad Maharaj, you know, these are so-called born in demonic families, but they're actually great devotees. So this Banasura, he had 1,000 arms. How do you have 1,000 arms in three-dimensional space? Like, try fitting like 4 or 5 arms. They begin to interfere with each other. And it says that he was firing 500 bows. He was working 500 bows with his 1,000 arms and shooting arrows at Krishna. This is straight out of the Krishna book. And we're not supposed to take this as mythology. See, some devotees take the tack. This is a very dangerous tack of saying, well, it's kind of nice fairy tales to help us to go to sleep at night peacefully. If you're too agitated, it's like fairy tales. That's offensive. That's an aparad. To take the Shastra as mythology is a great aparad. But so we say, okay, I have to believe it. But it's impossible. How do you have 1,000 arms? It's just like, then your mind gets like into this rasa bas. It's like you have to separate. You have 2 halves of your cranium. And you're trying to put these 2 things together. On the one side, I want to be a devotee. The Indian people are, I want to be a devotee. And the Americans who are like us in the ashram, we're in the same trouble. I want to be a devotee, but this is impossible. You cannot have 1,000 arms. It's just no one has 1,000 arms. And even, you want to hear something more mind-blowing is Madhyamaka chapter 21, text 84, when Brahma came to see Krishna in Dvarka. Everyone knows the story? This is the most. And Krishna summoned other Brahmas. I love the story, but I won't tell it now because I think everyone will shoot me at gunpoint. This is Madhyamaka chapter 20, text 84. When our Brahma with 4 heads came to see Krishna, Krishna smiled and called Brahmas from other universes having millions of heads. So you got 2 options. Okay, you can say the Shastra is wrong. That's an aparad. So it hurts your spiritual advancement to not believe in the Shastra. Or on the other hand, I believe this, but I'm a fool because it's impossible. So you're like, your cranium is divided. So that's where quantum mechanics comes in, with higher dimensional space and string theory. Scientists are seriously entertaining thoughts equivalent to what is being discussed in the Vedas. They're seriously talking about string theory. That's a big thing. It's a major theory in modern physics of how the universe operates. And as I mentioned in the beginning of class, 75% of the universe is invisible, or it's completely imperceptible. Not only invisible, but it's missing matter. If 75% of your house is missing, that's like a big problem. If you wake up one morning and 75% of the temple is gone, I mean, that's like a it's not like an inconsequential problem. There's a big problem in science because the way galaxies rotate, the way spiral galaxies rotate blows everyone's mind. They can't be doing that. It's just impossible. They're rotating at a speed that's impossible given the normal understanding of how gravity should operate. So one solution to the problem is to postulate higher dimensional regions, just like Banasura. It's exactly the same thing. They postulate higher dimensional regions where there are massive objects that cause the galaxies to rotate the way they appear to do. This is another whole topic, since you raised the string theory. But the value of hearing this, the reason I'm saying this is that if someone comes to become a devotee and they hear what I'm saying now, they can understand that it's actually a higher kind of science. When it says in the Vedas that Banasura has 1,000 arms, it's not the naive, and it's not a mythological statement. It's actually a higher kind of science. There's many things I won't... This is a great topic, actually, for discussion. Maybe it should be a Sunday feast topic, actually. Or some other... In Poland and Russia, we had 5 and 6 hour seminars that went on for a week, 5 hours a day, to cover these topics. But we cannot... Polish people and Russians are very patient. They join by the thousands and sit there and listen to you forever. But Americans are rajagun. They're up and running. But anyway, this is good for our... This is helping to overcome doubts. It's called sambandha jnana. Everyone has heard the term sambandha? That means our relationship between us, the universe, and God. There are three elements. What is matter? What is the soul? And what is the super soul? This is sambandha jnana. And Bhagavad Gita is sambandha jnana. But very introductory. So Bhagavatam with Maharaj Kukudmi, they're talking about something. And a naive person will say, this is impossible. How could 1 hour on Brahmaloka be 100 million years on the earth? A person who's not well-versed in modern physics would say, this is impossible. The Bhagavatam is full of impossible things. It says there are rivers of mango juice on the moon. There are giant mangoes, and when they hit, they fall off and they hit jagged rocks and they burst open, and there's rivers of mango juice on the moon. This is the fifth canto. We're getting up to it. So this is a major problem for Westerners. And Prabhupada wanted the Bhagavatam distributed. We don't distribute it the way we did in the 70s. We distributed so much, all the cantos, everyone was going wild. Even Chaitanya Charitamrita was distributed on the street when he came out in 1975. Prabhupada said, distribute this. Devotees said, this is too rasika. You know, Lord Chaitanya and separation of Radha and Krishna, too rasika and Vasudev Dat. How are people going to understand these things? And the vomit... The leper Brahman Vasudev is putting the worms back in his body. I mean, this is too far out for Americans. Prabhupada said, no, print large run, 100,000 copies each, 1975. They were distributing Chaitanya Charitamrita on the street. And we, even nowadays, devotees themselves don't read Chaitanya Charitamrita, which you should, because it's our life and soul. And it has physics. Along the way, there are some far-out hints about very exalted kinds of physics, like I mentioned. This pastime from Majjhava chapter 1, that's a very high level kind of physics. A multidimensional, higher dimensional space is being touched upon. Or Sanatana Goswami's statement that you can turn bell metal into gold. Well, bell metal is made out of copper and tin, and if you add up the number of protons in the nucleus of copper and the number of protons in the nucleus of tin, it adds up to the number of protons in the nucleus of gold. Of course, people will say this is alchemy. It's impossible to turn copper and tin into gold. This is foolish. That went away 300 years ago. That was like mythology. But actually, Sanatana Goswami is saying that. Yata diksha. You know that verse? Just as by diksha, a low-class man is transformed. It's Hari Bhakti Vilas 2.12. Hari Bhakti Vilas 2.12. As by diksha, a low-class man is transformed into a pure Brahman, so by alchemical manipulation, copper and tin is turned into gold. If you go to University of Chicago, they'll say, what are you talking about? This nonsense. Alchemy was outlawed, you know, hundreds of years ago in Europe. You guys are in the dark ages. But here's something far out. This is the most far out thing. If you look up the periodic table of the elements, I hope everyone knows what the periodic table of the elements is. The number of protons in the nucleus of copper is 29, and the number of protons in the nucleus of tin is 50, and the number of protons in the nucleus of gold is 79, So that if you would, if somehow you could add the nucleus, it's fusion. If you could fuse the nucleus of copper with the nucleus of tin, you would get the nucleus of gold, which is impossible at normal energies. You need a star. You need the fusion power of a giant sun. It cannot be done on the Earth planet, they say. But then there's now some, the French scientists, Louis Kervan, is talking about biological transmutation of elements. So that now it's actually being understood that it's going on all the time. So I'm getting carried away. But this is helping the faith. You see, our faith is Komala. One of my great Brahmachari friends, Jai Jagannath Prabhu, when I was in Boston slugging it out with the materialists at Harvard and MIT, my friend Jai Jagannath Prabhu sent me an email. He said, I have a godbrother with Komala Shraddha. Everyone should know what this means. Does everyone know what Komala Shraddha means? It means pliable, malleable, soft. Komala means weak, Shraddha means faith. Like Lord Chaitanya says in Sanatana Shiksha, the faith of a devotee, there are three stages you can measure the faith in terms of how strong, how weak and pliable. This Komala Shraddha. So Jai Jagannath Prabhu, he sent me this email. I have this friend, you know, one of my friends is studying chemistry, and he has his Komala Shraddha is being inundated and swept away by this Western nonsense. This is a big problem. We see devotees are isolated from reality. You don't know how people think out there. We're just, give me another pakora with some chutney. We don't understand these people are going to hell. They're suffering at these colleges. It's a slaughter. Prabhupada said these are slaughterhouses. Everyone is very proud. You go to the University of Chicago, they have the coat of arms, you know, and they're very proud, you know. Also, everyone. Prabhupada said these are slaughterhouses because they're training you up to be an animal, and next birth you take birth as a dog, if you're lucky. Mostly as a cockroach. Captain Karma. To the extent you violate Dharma, you are punished by Captain Karma. So the karmic overload of one life, Mayadevi said to Haridas Thakur in Anchala chapter 3, when Mayadevi begged for the Hare Krishna mantra, she said, the age of Kali is so sinful. In one human life without any devotion, you create so much karma, you have to stay for many kalpas. You cannot be delivered from any. And a kalpa is a day of about 4.3 billion years. So to say that you take birth as a cockroach is a good, that's one of your better slots. If your karma is exceptionally good, you can take birth as a cockroach. More likely you're going to take birth as one of the sukshma jivas, one of the jivas stuck in atoms or rocks, and be slowly, gradually, then you take birth as a bacterium, Indragopa. It says in Brahma Samhita, the Indragopa. And then you work your way up to a worm or what? A cockroach is a relatively elevated birth. They don't understand what's going on. When in Adila chapter 17, when Lord Chaitanya was talking to the Kazi, for every cow you kill, for every hair on the body of that cow, you have to suffer for 10 million births for every hair on the body of the cow. Now, of course, we'll say, oh, that's just the Shastra. What do you mean that's just the Shastra? I mean, that is the Shastra is our life and soul. We're supposed to accept what it says in the Shastra. Adilila chapter 17, Lord Chaitanya is talking to the Kazi. The Kazi is justifying meat eating. He says, you Vedic Brahmins, you had Ashvamedha Yajna and Gomedha Yajna. You were killing cows and Ashva. Ashva means horse. Killing cows and horses. Kazi was a smart guy. He said, you guys are killing animals too, right? And Lord Chaitanya said, wait a minute. They brought them back to life. It was an old animal, was put in the sacrificial fire and got a new birth. So all of this is, we're just trying to help people's faith. This faith is required to advance, Shraddha. How are you going to advance in devotional service if you don't have faith? How are you going to do all these austerities? Controlling your mind and senses, celibacy? For the long haul, many decades, this is not a cheap thing, you know, not so easy. To succeed in bhakti yoga, you have to have strong faith. And these Western nonsense people are trying to break your faith. So it's a fight, it's a struggle. You know, the nonsense people, and so we have to get up and fight. Prabhupada said we are Arjuna monks. So thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada ki.